and Mayor Rahm Emanuel, but also one that may be grounded in a larger national debate over the role and value of teachers in America. NPR's Cheryl Corley reports.
There hasn't been a school strike in Chicago for 25 years, but the current contract between Chicago teachers and the Chicago Public Schools expires at the end of next week. Recently, about 90% of the union's membership, nearly 24,000 workers, voted to support a strike if it's called. CTU President Karen Lewis says it was an indication of the rocky relationship between the union and school management and
the absolute abject lack of respect and scapegoating of teachers, paraprofessionals, and clinicians throughout this country. I mean, that's all we hear. Everything that's wrong with the educational system is our fault.
Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel wants more privately run charter schools. He stripped teachers of a 4% raise, and his effort to institute longer school days while sidestepping the union contract infuriated union members. Add to that a change in state law that set the threshold for a strike authorization vote at 75%. During the last day of school at Cesar Chavez Elementary School last week, art teacher Michael Bachner watched as other teachers ripped huge sheets of colored paper from rolls as they prepared for an evening celebration for students. Bachner says when teachers learned the new state law aimed at preventing a strike would count people who didn't vote as no votes, teachers realized it was a huge effort to blunt the union's power.
So here at Chavez, we had 100% participation on the first day, which is much more than we've ever had for any election before.
Mayor Emanuel denied that his support for the change in the state law backfired, but he did acknowledge the strong 90% vote.
It's a huge number.
Negotiators for the school district and the union are wrangling over wages, class size, and other issues. Even so, Emanuel offered a small olive branch as he talked about the wide gap in the proposals for teacher pay raises.
They deserve it, they've earned it, and appropriately have gotten it and should get it in the future. What I want to make sure is our children also have a full day and a full school year equal to their full potential, which has not been done to date.
Chicago School CEO Jean-Claude Brizard adds that no one in Chicago is looking to mirror Wisconsin by trying to do away with negotiating rights.
No Wisconsin here, and I don't think we need Wisconsin here. But again, what I want is I don't want my kids being caught in the middle of all of this. I don't want my families anxious about what's going to be happening in September.
University of Illinois Chicago labor professor Robert Bruno says although there are lessons that both the union and school board can take away from the Wisconsin saga, he says Mayor Emanuel, former chief of staff to President Obama, may also have another question to consider.
How exactly does it look to have a major collective bargaining dispute, a strike of public sector workers in his home city on the eve of a tight presidential election with battleground states all around Illinois?
It may not come to that. The union and school leaders say they're looking for common ground as the negotiations continue. And CTU President Lewis says the 90% strike authorization vote is making those negotiations just a little bit easier. Cheryl Corley, NPR News, Chicago.
The U.S. Olympic trials in track and field begin tomorrow. Among the dozens of athletes hoping to leap, throw, or run their way to London is St. Louis native Shannon Leinart. The 24-year-old runner has dreamed of the Olympics since she was 10, but it's not her only pursuit. Rachel Lippman of St. Louis Public Radio has this profile.
It's a hot, windy spring day on the campus of the University of Missouri Columbia, but that doesn't keep Shannon Leinart from her training. Leinart, 24, is beating the heat in pink shorts and a black sports bra. Her long brown hair whips her face as she sprints around a red cinder track, neon blue and green spikes pounding.
Shannon.
It was on this track that Leinart revived her college career, which allowed her to think seriously about the Olympics. But it was at this school that she fell in love with special needs students and decided to try to earn a PhD in special education. She then chose to tackle training and studying at the same time.
At the beginning, yes, it was such an easy decision because I felt like school and running is a great complement for each other.
Her boyfriend and sometime training partner, Dan Quigley, wasn't alone in thinking that probably wasn't the best idea.
I've continually challenged her to lighten her load a little bit in terms of school so that she can be more competitive, just because I see this as, you know, a kind of maybe once or twice in a lifetime opportunity. And she continues to challenge herself really hard, both in school and on the track. You know, she never backs down from anything.
Leinart appears to be the ultimate multitasker, but admits it took time to adjust to the demands placed on her by the high level of both academics and athletics.
I think my running suffered a lot, and then this year I'd say that I've been a little bit more selfish with my running, and I'll close my laptop around like 11:30 and just go to bed.
Fred Bingley coached the 1988 Olympic champion in the men's 800 race and has worked with Leinart for the past 2 years. He says once everything started clicking for her, the difference was night and day.
You saw a happy person. You saw a positive person. She only had about 1 2-week period during the whole year that she seemed like she wasn't going to be able to handle everything. And she was able to fight through that and really just get better and better and better.
That ability doesn't surprise Leinart's college coach, Rebecca Wilmes.
There's a lot of soul searching, I think, an athlete in that situation does. And yeah, she had to go through it and get to the other side, still rolling and loving it. Things come together for her. It's a pattern.
And Leinart's definitely rolling. When the outdoor track season started in March, she was completing the two laps of an 800 in 2 minutes, 7 seconds. Earlier this month, her time was down to a hair over 2 minutes. She'll need to be even faster, though, to get to London.
158 to 159.
Do you think you can do it?
Yeah, I do. And especially after my workout the other day, I would not be surprised this time if I actually went under 2.
Fred Bingley is just as confident, and he says it's nice to see Shannon end on a high note after struggling.
If nothing else, she's going to come out with a personal best time-wise. And she's still young enough. If she doesn't make this Olympic team, you need to look 4 more years down the road.
The 2016 Games in Rio are already on Shannon Leinart's mind. On her agenda before that, defending her dissertation next year. For NPR News, I'm Rachel Lippman in St. Louis.
It's been 40 years since the adoption of Title IX, the gender equality law that changed college athletics for both women and men. Commentator Frank DeFord considers what it means going forward.
Saturday is the 40th anniversary of Title IX, which, although almost nobody anticipated it then, resulted in women gaining the right to participate in sports commensurate with their numbers attending college. Title IX not only had a huge effect on women's participation in sports, but also culturally, it influenced the way both men and women view the idea of women in athletics. It's mattered greatly in our American society. But now, what of the future effects of Title IX? First of all, I see a potential of a great grand collision between the old law and the recent major medical revelation. As the attendance of women in college has increased, so-called minor men's sports, like wrestling and tennis, even baseball, have had to be dropped to keep in compliance with the law. But now, as the number of women in college approaches 60%, while concurrently, evidence mounts that football damages boys' brains, King football may be the sport in jeopardy, especially as it's so expensive and has no female analog. Already in one prominent school district, it's been proposed that football should be eliminated, that schools have no business promoting a gladiator sport. How ironic it would be that women's academic predominance would play a part in America's most popular sport being cut down at its roots. But on the other hand, even as women's participation in sport has soared, there's been no corresponding interest in women watching other women play sports. The only pro-female team sport of any sustaining viability is the WNBA, which is allowed to serve at the pleasure of its NBA benefactor in basketball off-season. The most visible women's sport is tennis. On those few weeks in major tournaments, when the females gain a share of the spotlight alongside the more popular men. To be sure, yes, there are many women sports fans, but their numbers and passion are minuscule compared to the mass of male spectators. But so what? Is it really necessary to have it, as Lerner and Lowe wrote in My Fair Lady, for the misogynistic Henry Higgins?
Why can't a woman be more like a man? Men are so honest, so thoroughly square, eternally noble, historically fair. But when you win, we'll always give your back a pat. Well, why can't a woman be like that?
Why can't a woman be more like a man? Myself, I think we've already got a quota enough of men being like men. But still, the question for the next 40 years of Title IX will be, why can't a woman be more like a fan.
The comments of Frank DeFord, whose most recent book is Over Time, My Life as a Sports Writer.
Thanks to your contributions this year, you've kept the news and information programs flowing.
It's Morning Edition on WILL. I'm Jim Meadows.
This is Focus, WILL AM's morning talk show. I'm David Inge.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with the opening commodity market report.
You're listening to the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Craig Cohen.
There's still time for you to help support the news and information programs you value. Call 217-244-9455 to make your contribution.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday. It's the 20th of June, 2012. It was on this date in 1837, the 18-year-old Alexandrina Victoria became Queen of England. She was known to her family as Drina. She'd had a quiet childhood, well-educated in music and history and foreign languages, living well-protected at Kensington Palace in London. She was fifth in line for the throne behind her uncles and her father, but one by one they all died. And on this day in 1837, she got the news that she was now the queen. Queen Victoria reigned for 63 years. It's the 60th birthday of the novelist Vikram Seth, born in Calcutta, 1952, author of A Suitable Boy, one of the longest single-volume works of fiction in the English language, about 500 pages in paperback. The sequel, A Suitable Girl, is supposed to be published sometime next year. It was on this date in 1840 Samuel Morse got a patent for his Morse code system. He was a painter. He'd studied photography with Louis Daguerre in France, opened a photographic studio in New York City. Morse had the idea that electromagnetic current could actually move a pencil along a moving strip of paper. It was his assistant, Alfred Vail, who came up with the dot and dash code. So it should be known as Vail code, but Morse was the better known of them, and he was the boss, so it's called Morse code. Here's a poem for today by Glenn Shea, entitled The Flowering. I love to imagine London, fallen, quiet, silent, really, just past the toll of 12, walking past the white bulk of St. Paul's or by the steps of Paternoster Square, not of the panicked silences of nights of the Blitz, but merely unpeopled streets, London, asleep,